My understanding of the classical liberal movement started with dinner, salad, and dessert at the nightly dinners my family shared as I was growing up. It was illuminated in the discussions and debates my sisters, brother, and I listened to my parents and their friends recall by telling stories of Frank Meyer, Milton Friedman, and Wilmore Kendall, among others. It was the stacks and stacks of books and articles that would land in our hands after asking my dad a question about global warming, Austrian economics, or Ronald Reagan's foreign policy. As we grew older, it was the ideas that we, my siblings and I, eventually tested and explored on our own around the same dinner table. This sort of learning led me to Notre Dame, where I pursued a major in the program of liberal studies, a great books program, and then to Washington, D.C., where I've been involved with America's Future Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the next generation of leaders of the classical liberal movement, and to K-12, an education company focused on developing traditional curriculum and delivering it to children anywhere, anytime. At the core of my learning, from the family dinner table debates to the business of selling curriculum to schools across the country, was the importance of education for a good and free society. And without fully understanding its depths, but in acknowledging my debts to it, I knew the classical liberal movement was the framework for preserving the value and promise of education in American society. To prognosticate on the direction of the classical liberal movement, I would like to turn to the next generation of leaders who are engaging on the front lines of education in America's homes and classrooms. What would be their answer to this question? Why do we need a good and free society? Would they consider education as a precondition for a free society? Would they recognize what Edmund Burke warned us about, the subtle ransoming of personal liberties for order? As a response, let me begin by explaining a little bit more about my involvement with America's Future Foundation and my work at K-12. AFS network of young 20 to 30-something professionals meet regularly to debate political and cultural topics, topics that are both timely and timeless. At our most recent roundtable, we debated gay marriage with former Congressman Bob Barr, journalist Andrew Sullivan, AEI scholar Phil Monius, and heritage scholar Matthew Spaulding. The monthly roundtables have grown from a small group of 10 regulars to an overflowing room of 100 young, eager faces who are bright, liberty-minded dwellers of the capital city. We also publish a quarterly magazine, Doublethink, and a weekly web magazine, Brainwash, which provide a space for aspiring young intellectuals and journalists to develop their thoughts on culture, politics, and the world of ideas. The mission of all AFS programs is to educate and to help talented young people who are committed to these classical liberal ideas and to move them into positions where they can play important leadership roles in the movement for freedom and in American society. If the composition and, moreover, the potential of these young leaders is any indicator of the health of the classical liberal movement, then I do believe there's hope for the next 40 years. At K-12, I've been involved with education's best and worst in America. From teachers in the classroom, to a university board of trustees, from state legislators, to the U.S. Department of Education. Throughout this time, I've learned the ins and outs of our education system from the local, state, and national level. I now surprisingly understand how to calculate the formula for per pupil funding in Oklahoma based on a convoluted and outdated equalization scheme, and I can advise on how to negotiate a union contract with a small school district in Pocahontas, Iowa, since the contract did not allow for teachers to work past 3 o'clock on Fridays. Exposure to this level of detail and analysis taught me to be cautious with regards to the new laws and regulations promoted by those who felt that every program in our schools needed a regulatory box with a red bow on it. What was continually lost in this so-called progress was the quality and purpose of education. In this work, I've seen enough to give me hope, but enough of the worst to see great doubt that public education can ever bear the great responsibility of educating children and young adults on its own. Honestly, doubt outweighs my hope on this front, because as far as I can tell, education in our society is gravely ill. And by education, I mean not only teaching children to write, to read, to calculate, but also to understand history, and in Paul Johnson's words, to discover how many of our glib assumptions, which seem to us novel and plausible, have been tested before, but not once, but many times and in innumerable guises, and discovered to be, at great human cost, wholly false. By education, I mean not only to understand the scientific method, but to know the theories of Euclid, Copernicus, Bacon, Newton, and Einstein. I could go on to tell you about the pitfalls I've seen in classrooms or in overregulated state departments of education, but the force behind all of this is that American society is not well educated. Why is this illness absent from the front pages of every newspaper in the country? First, if you question the state of education in this country, you will probably receive a startled, unsure, and many times hostile response from those who are in the trenches. Go further, and you may even start a frenzy of activity creating a constitutional amendment protecting what many believe is the right to public education. But a right? By most state constitutions, you will find it described as a public good and a public responsibility of a local community, but not a right. And knowing all this, how would they, our next generation, respond to what is needed for a good and free society? It is safe to say that one of the young professionals attending an AFF event would reflect on the need for a good and free society and probably acknowledge that Burke had it right. Those who do not practice self-restraint and honest dealings necessary for a good and free society will find themselves subject to constraints of their liberty imposed from without. However, those in the trenches, at home, and in the classroom may disregard Burke, and they may, in fact, sacrifice freedom for order. What does this mean for the movement and its future? We have plenty of policy think tanks for legislating this and that. We have a good number of magazines and journals examining conservative and libertarian ideas and this and that. Very few people, however, deal with the questions of good and evil, right and wrong. For the children who attend schools where these terms are muddied by situational ethics or personal morality, there is no choice, no freedom. Some of the parents of these children face the dawning reality that without reform, there will be regret. What these parents clamor for is the chance to demonstrate what education can offer to their children. What they need most of all is the leadership to take up this task and to engage in this battle daily. This, I believe, is a challenge the classical liberal movement will face in the next 40 years. America's Future Foundation's mission is an answer to this challenge. The challenge will not only be met by the generation who founded and led the movement for the last 40 years through the Philadelphia Society and other like-minded organizations. It is a calling to the next generation of liberty-minded leaders to lead and understand our history while engaging in the cultural battle for America's education system and in order to preserve our good and free society.